Ooh, it's a busy day in Davos, Switzerland. Check it out.
Hello, you've reached the Davos World Economic Forum activity line. Here are the events for Wednesday, January 28th, 2009. The Economist's Group Hug Workshop begins promptly at 8 a.m. and is completely full. No latecomers will be admitted. The workshop, Charles Ponzi, Swindler or Visionary? Lessons for Today's World, the John Thane Keynote, has been canceled. No further information. Instead, former World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz will lead the seminar, How to Live Rent-Free in Your Unused Gulfstream 5. The 10 o'clock, Make Real Money, Selling Your Stuff on eBay, Bankers Can Do It Too, has been moved to the main auditorium. Losing Billions and Finding the Meaning of Life, the Warren Buffett workshop, has been canceled for lack of interest and replaced by Martha Stewart's Wallpapering with Credit Default Swaps, A New Look for a New Century. The Citigroup Luncheon Reception is now a cash bar event. Drink tickets can be obtained from Mr. Vikram Pandit at the Citigroup booth. The CEO Job Fair has been extended for an additional session. It will begin right after the breakout. Thinking Beyond Capitalism, Tips on Relocating to China. If you're looking for where Bernie Madoff put all the money, get in line. Remember, the World Economic Forum 2009 accepts only cash. We're not as dumb as you think.
Because we're the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, January 28th. And gee, John, that doesn't sound like any fun.
No, that was the could-not-resist department acting up there. Good morning.
Well, hopefully they're enjoying themselves despite that. Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone. Today we go to Baghdad for the latest on their upcoming elections. We're going to go to France for the food competition that is unlike no other. And we're going to talk about Barack Obama and bipartisanship. Those stories are coming up, but first, the top stories at this hour.
Well, Washington may lack the snowy peaks of Davos, but it certainly has its own economic forum today. The House will vote on the proposed $825 billion stimulus package. President Obama made a personal pitch for House Republican support. GOP House Leader John Boehner says it sure was nice of him to drop by, but
clearly there are some differences that were expressed with regard to the economic rescue package. I think we both share a sincere belief that we have to have a plan that works.
Republican support may not be there in the House, but it'll be better in the Senate. Today, President Obama visits the Pentagon. He's going to be looking at the withdrawal from Iraq plan within 16 months. Details to be worked out.
The president's Middle East special envoy, George Mitchell, plans to visit Israelis and Palestinians today. This will be the most closely watched meetings of his trip. Arab League chief Amar Moussa is optimistic.
We are full of hope that Senator Mitchell will succeed. We know him, and since he was senator and since he worked on his famous report under the Clinton administration, at the end of the Clinton administration.
As ceasefires go, the one in Gaza seems rather fiery. Today, Israeli warplanes bombed tunnels into Gaza that officials say where weapons were smuggled.
It's lights out for tens of thousands in the Southwest and Midwest because of weather. The Dow starts trading at 8174. John Updike is dead at age 76, and his lament is that we're not reading or writing as much as we used to. Was Updike right? What's the last book you read and why? And if it was Updike, so much the better. 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. As we noted at the end of the newscast, John Updike's passing at age 76. He wrote 50 books in 50 years, one per year. That's a frightening output.
Yeah, that's why he is who he was.
Yeah, indeed. And he was a voice
one
of
a
American letters and an advocate for reading and writing. And we wanted to ask the question more straightforwardly at the top of the show. Was John Updike right? Are books declining? Is reading going out of fashion? If you don't read books, what do you read? Is there a blogger that you can't get enough of? Call us at 8778 MY TAKE with the last book you read. And if it was an Updike book, great. Or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. It's a celebration of books. John Updike would be very happy if he was listening to The Takeaway this morning. There is a very important test this week in Iraq of the fledgling democracy in that country as the U.S. contemplates withdrawal of its forces from Iraq. The Iraqi government is going to have to take the reins, and a test comes on Saturday as provincial elections get underway involving 15 million Iraqis who are eligible to vote. Andrew North, BBC Baghdad correspondent, joins us from Baghdad. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
And Marina Ottaway is the director of the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She joins us from Washington. Marina, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
First of all, Andrew North, give us a sense of the excitement of this impending vote on Saturday, if there is any.
Well, I think that's the right question, because having been back in Iraq for just over a week in the run-up to these elections, it's a very low-key campaign so far. Now, when you drive around Baghdad and other cities, I drove south to the city of Najaf yesterday, you see posters all over the place for all the many thousands of candidates that are running. But there's no real sense of election fever, partly for reasons of security. There aren't many big rallies. People are still scared of possible attacks if there's large gatherings out in the open. So generally, they're tending to hold political rallies inside where they think it'll be a bit safer. And I think the other thing, the other element to this is that a lot of people are very sceptical about whether their politicians can really deliver. They haven't been too impressed with the kinds of politicians their fledgling democracy has delivered so far.
Marina Ottaway, certainly one is tempted to conclude from what Andrew North is saying that there is a degree of skepticism on the part of Iraqis that might suggest they don't really believe in their democracy. But is there another way of looking at this, that possibly getting away from the hysteria of the early Bush years in Iraq might be a good thing for people to think of government and elections as something that's part of day-to-day life?
Well, I tend to share the skepticism about the idea that these elections are going to change anything drastically in the country. There are three issues that are involved in the election as I see it. One is the distribution of power between Shia and Sunni, and I don't think elections are going to be a major difference. Even if the Sunnis vote in large numbers, as they did not in the last election, they are still going to emerge from the election as the minority, as a minority group, not as the majority. So I think that there will still be a certain sense of grievance on the part of the Sunni community. The second issue is, and that's probably the most important, is the distribution of power among Shia organizations on one side and Sunni organizations on the other. And that is where I think we may see some change, in the sense that many of the Sunni parties that are in the parliament now are not expected to do terribly well. And then there is the break on the Shia part, there is a breakdown of the coalition between the prime minister and the movement of al-Hakim. And that is probably the most important part of the election.
Well, and what you're describing paves the way for a further consolidation on the part of Shiite parties. I'm wondering if there's any way for this provincial election to change the sort of designated status quo at the national level, which has a Kurdish president, a Shia prime minister, and some Sunni participation in the ministries. Is that going to pretty much stay the equilibrium point, the stalemate?
Well, that is going to remain until the national elections that are going to take place at the end of the year. These are just elections for the provincial councils. The only thing that might change, but this we'll have to see in the future, is the balance of power between the central government and the provincial governments. At this point, the power is all in the hands of the central government. The provincial governments have very little power. The new election law theoretically gives a little more power to the provincial councils, but we'll have to see how it plays out in practice, because it's a country with a strong tradition of centralization, and the government is not going to give up easily.
Andrew North, let's talk about that for a moment. These are provincial elections. What sort of local control do village and city councils have, and what can they acquire in the next several years leading up to national elections?
Well, in some ways, this election is crucial in settling that, because There are some who want provincial councils and particularly regional provincial governors to have much more power. At the moment, they do have their own budget, so therefore they have quite a lot of influence over what money can be spent on in their areas. And so that's one reason why they matter. But there's a particularly important battle that is going on down in the south, which will have much longer term ramifications, because one party, Hakim, the group led by Abdulaziz Al-Hakim, which Marina was referring to there, which is the Supreme Council, which is in fact close to the US, they are now pushing forward a program to turn the southern nine provinces, which are all majority Shia, into a new super region, and they would make Najaf, the holy city of Najaf, the capital of this super region. In other words, therefore, they would be taking much more power there to decide their own affairs.
Would that be mirrored on the Kurdish semi-autonomous region in the north, or something exactly, more like partition?
Exactly.
I see.
That's right. They are citing the Kurdish region as the example, as the model, and saying, well, if they have one, why shouldn't we do the same? And this would be good for our people down there. But it's not just that there's opposition from the Sunni side. There's opposition within the Shia parties to this idea, with some saying that this could, if it is pushed forward, lead to the breakup of Iraq. And, of course, it's particularly interesting given that the Supreme Council is, at the moment, still seen as being very close to the US, who generally they support some federalism, some push to give more power to the regions, but not if it goes to the extent of leading to the breakup of the country. So it's potentially quite a sensitive issue, and that's one reason why these elections, although in many ways they're being seen as a kind of test of where the country is and also a guide to what will happen in the elections at the end of the year, the more important elections, they could actually produce new fault lines in the country.
And Marina, the fact that there are 14,000 candidates for just 440 council seats, does that reflect how fractured the leadership is for both the Shia and Sunni communities?
I think this is fairly typical in countries that never had election before or do not have a tradition of democracy, that in the early election you have an enormous number of freelancers, of would-be parties. There are something like 400 parties in Iraq at this point, but organizations and candidates that don't have any chance of ever getting elected. It seems to happen in all first or second elections in all countries, so I would not attach too much importance to that.
Well, let's track the money, if we could, in the last minute or so that we have. Marina and then Andrew, if you could respond to this. The U.S. handed over the payment of village councils in Anbar province, and there was not an explosion either of corruption or instability. So it appears that administering money at that level, the Iraqi military is fairly good at. Is there any sense that the central government or the village councils with their budgets are doing a better job of distributing money without being accused of corruption? Marina and then Andrew.
I really don't know how to answer that, in the sense that there has been much less scrutiny on the local governments and on the provincial governments than there has been at the national level. I would expect, frankly, corruption to be widespread at all levels. We just know more about what goes on at the center.
Oh, man, you're tough, Marina. Andrew?
Well, one thing I would say is it does depend on where you go. I was certainly struck yesterday when I travelled down to Najaf on how good a condition the city of Najaf is in compared to Baghdad. Infrastructure-wise, Baghdad needs a lot of work. There are some bits and pieces going on here and there, some bridges being rebuilt and this kind of thing. But Najaf is in a lot better condition. A lot more money seems to have been spent down there. And this is a place that 4 years ago, you may remember, was hit by very heavy fighting
Indeed.
Between U.S. forces and the militia of Muqtada Sadr.
Well,
so I think it depends on where you go.
The tough nut is Baghdad, and we'll see more about that as these provincial elections take place on Saturday. Andrew North, BBC Baghdad correspondent, thank you. And Marina Ottaway, director of the Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.